Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to talk about what to do in the spring. Weeds are an issue, and it's a kind of a good time. I mean, they're peeking out right now, be honest. And so it's a good time to maybe think about controlling them. So that's one of the things we're going to talk about with Diana Alfuth. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. And we're going to be talking about ways to stop weeds from coming up. And we'll also be taking your other gardening questions as well. So maybe you've had problems with weeds. Maybe you've had some other issues. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Diana Alfuth, welcome to the program.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. And, you know, weeds, you know, I hate to think about weeds already when it's still kind of, you know, it's not the time to get out there necessarily, but this is a good time to think about weed control. What do you think?
Well, it is. And right now, all we gardeners, we're all enthusiastic and we're picturing the perfect gardens. And we're not picturing weeds in those gardens, but we have to remember back to late July when the weeds were taller than our tomatoes and that kind of thing. Weeds get out of control very quickly. And we love to garden, but we don't like it when those weeds overtake it and it becomes such a chore. So it is the time to think about how are you going to eliminate or prevent those weeds in the first place. And there's a lot of easy things to do that maybe take a little more work right away in the spring, but it pays off for the whole season. And the kind of weed control you do will kind of depend on what it is, where in your garden. So whether it's in your perennial beds, in your annual beds, in your vegetable garden, there are different methods. But like I said, a little bit of work now can really prevent that backbreaking, tedious, frustrating
job. I hate weeding.
I don't know that I've ever met anyone who enjoys it.
You know, my vegetable garden, my parents had tons of leaves left over from the year before, and I would always have those bagged up, and I would throw that mulch. I had a big garden, and my garden would be covered with leaves about 6 inches deep.
Right.
Well, and I didn't have to do very much weeding.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So let's talk about vegetable gardens first. One of the best things that you can do to prevent that July horror jungle is to mulch. One of the best things that you can do is, that's the other key. You got to do this right away because once the weeds are 3 or 4 inches high,
they're indestructible.
You're already behind. So as soon as when we start the gardens in the spring, we work up the soil and everything is nice and clean, and then we plant our seeds or our transplants. So let's say you're planting your tomatoes and you put your transplant in. Right away, what you should do is put down newspaper. You can use any kind of typical newspaper that has just black and white ink on it. Even a lot of the colored inks, as long as they're not on glossy paper, are fine. They're all made out of soy, so they're organic. And using newspaper as mulch is a certified organic method. So you plant your tomatoes, and then you cover all the air, because there's a lot of open space between tomato plants. There should be, exactly, for good air circulation. You'll have less problems with tomato blight and fungal issues and that sort of thing. So when your tomato plants are small, there's a lot of open space in between them, and the weeds love that. So if you just put down, you can be collecting newspapers all winter here. There's still time. Put down about 5 to 7 sheets thick of newspaper and hose it down as you do it so it sticks and it doesn't blow around. And then put some kind of an organic mulch on top of it. And it could be those leaves that you mentioned, or it could be grass clippings or straw or pine needles if you have them. But put a few inches on top of that so that it's thick. And what this does is all those weed seeds that are in your soil, and no matter how good of a gardener you are, your soil is full of weed seeds, they won't sprout because they're in the dark and they're smothered by this newspaper. So you should be able to get pretty much through the whole season before that stuff decomposes enough and weeds would start popping through.
So if you haven't been saving your newspapers, now is a pretty good time to start saving them. Put them in a box in the back room.
And we don't have that many newspapers anymore, and I don't recommend using your iPad, which is how you maybe read your newspaper nowadays. Don't use that. But you can also use cardboard, corrugated cardboard, so the basic cardboard box.
Yep.
People think there are glues and adhesives in there, but there actually isn't. That's all stuck together with just cellulose. So if it's nice, clean cardboard, I don't recommend using things like cereal boxes because that does have adhesives and inks and dyes and stuff on it that you maybe don't want in your vegetable garden soil. But plain corrugated cardboard is another thing. Any kind of recyclable paper can work for this. And then at the end of the year, because it's paper, of course, it was originally made from trees, and it's just organic matter. So at the end of the year, it's rotting in. The mulch that's on top of it is decomposing. You just work that into your soil, and it's actually an organic soil amendment. So it's improving your soil for the future. And of course, that mulch serves other purposes, too. Around your tomatoes, it stops soil from splashing up on the tomato leaves, which is how these tomato diseases get started, Septoria leaf spot and what everybody always calls blight, early blight. So it helps with that, and it helps to maintain even moisture in that soil, so you don't have to irrigate as much. I suggest putting a soaker hose underneath all of this so that when you do need to water, you are watering the soil and not the leaves. And one of the things that causes cracking of tomatoes in summer is when it gets dried out and then a lot of rain or a lot of water and then dry and then a lot of water. And using this mulch helps to moderate that, so you'll have less cracking as well. But it's not just around tomatoes. All of your plants, your whole garden should
be the whole garden, sure.
Right. And so if you plant your row of beans, you might want to wait until they just start germinating so you know where that row is, because obviously you don't want to cover the bean seeds with the newspaper and mulch. But go right up to the plants, like within an inch, and then you'll have very, very few weeds that you have to pull, and they're just right around the plants. So that's one of the best ways. And you can do that in a perennial bed as well. If you're putting in a new garden, you can use the newspaper and mulch method. You can do that with annual flowers. And it's very effective, and it's very environmentally sound as well.
Absolutely. Well, Bill in Madison has a question for you or a comment. Let's go there. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Am I on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, are you there? Bill's
Hello?
Not... Bill, for some reason...
Hello?
For some reason, Bill is not here. Let's see if I can try... Bill, are you there? Oh, very interesting. Let's try once more. Hi, Bill, are you there?
Hello?
For some reason, Bill is not hearing us, and I'm not sure why. I know he has a question relating to mulch and whether or not to pull off the mulch to let the soil warm up. And what about that? If you've got mulch that's in your area, do you want to pull that off or not?
Yeah. If it's something like, if he's talking about mulch that maybe you put over perennials or over strawberries or something like that, you would need to be pulling that off. And pretty soon, now I know it's, you know, I mean, I'm up in the north central part of the state, and we've had a lot of the frost out of the ground already with our warm spell previously, and now it's supposed to get warmer again here this coming week and stuff.
Yeah.
So usually we're looking at the end of March, the beginning of April, but if the soil is where there's not mulch, if the frost is coming out, it's not a bad idea to pull that off now. And hopefully the soil will be frozen yet, or at least frosty, underneath that mulch, and that's been keeping the plants dormant. So you do need to pull that mulch off as those plants become active so that they're not in the dark.
Yeah,
okay?
Sure.
And then you can just put that mulch, you can just put it, fluff it in between the rows to do this weed control that we talked about. But as far as, like if it's around perennials or something, you don't need to move that if it's not over the top of a plant. It's just that soil will warm up a little bit slower, but it will eventually warm up and your perennials will be growing and everything is right on track there.
Hunky-dory.
So it depends on what kind of mulch he's talking about, I guess.
Let's turn to John in Green Bay. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. For some reason, we're not getting...
Hello?
Hi, John, are you there? Huh. I can't figure out what's going on with our calls today.
What's going on?
So I'm not quite sure. John, are you there? Let's try it once more.
It clicked like I don't hear you, Larry. So it clicked like I was going to be on the air, but I don't hear anything.
Oh, well, he has a question about weed barriers.
Okay. Well, we can talk about weed barriers. So weed barriers are, sometimes people just use like black plastic, or else there are landscape fabric weed barriers that are available out there. And they're very common, but really they should, in my opinion, they're overused, and they really should not be used under an organic mulch. So let me explain why. If you... are doing like a perennial bed, for example, or a shrub bed. If you put one of these weed barriers on and then you put like shredded wood mulch on top of it, what happens over the course of the next couple of years is that wood mulch that's on top of that barrier will decompose because it's exposed to moisture and microbes and everything, and so it'll decompose. And then you get this nice little compost layer on top of that weed barrier. So the weed barrier will have smothered or stopped weeds that were in the soil when you put the barrier down from germinating. But then you've got this nice little compost layer on top of the weed barrier, and new weeds, seeds that blow in and stuff are going to germinate in that. And then a lot of times, you know how strong a dandelion root can be. It'll punch right through that weed barrier. And then if you pull it up, you pull the weed barrier up as well. And you can put more wood mulch on top, but eventually you've got, you know, several inches of wood and decomposed wood on top of a weed barrier that's now not serving any purpose whatsoever. So it's better if in a perennial bed or a shrub bed, if you skip the weed barrier and just put on 4 to 5 inches of shredded wood. That thickness of that mulch is going to smother out and keep the weed seeds that are in the soil from germinating. And yes, every couple of years you need to top dress it to replenish that, because if you let that wood mulch decompose down to, you know, an inch or something, you're going to get weeds growing in there. So you do have to replenish it every few years, but then you don't have this useless, shredding, messy weed barrier down in there. Now, the place that weed barriers should be used is only if you're using a non-organic mulch, so like rock. So some people will use landscape rock in their shrub beds and that sort of a thing. And that rock, because there's so much space in between each rock, moisture and sunlight can get down in there, and so the rock would not keep the weed seeds that are in the soil from germinating. However, what happens...
however.
There's always a however, right?
Yes, there always is.
A lot of times people think, well, I want to do the rock mulch with the weed barrier because it's less maintenance, because you don't have to top dress it with the wood every couple of years. But what happens is... Every year, you know, leaves fall off and dust blows in and it comes on that rock and it sifts its way down to the bottom of the rock and it's on top of that weed barrier where it forms a tiny little dust and compost and soil layer. So then after a few years, you can have weed seeds work between the rocks, and they are very opportunistic and they don't need much little soil or compost mix to germinate. So a lot of times then you get weeds growing in between your rocks because they're growing in the compost and dust and dirt that's on top of that weed barrier in there. So it's not really less maintenance than top dressing. But the bottom line to the question, at least what we think the question was, is if you're using an organic mulch, you really shouldn't use a weed barrier. Because while it will keep weeds from sprouting that first year, after that, it's really not useful at all, and it kind of gets in the way of things.
Yeah, oh, I had some experience with that. Many years ago, I used it. I was thinking I was such a smart guy. And then to pull that out later is such a pain in the butt.
It is, because it starts to break down. It doesn't last forever. So when you start pulling it out, it's ripping and tearing, and there's little pieces, and then you got plastic in your soil forever. And
never again for me. Diana Olfuth is our guest today as we talk with her about all things in the garden. We're having some phone issues, so if you've got a question, you can email us, and we'll take those. Or if you call, Lexi can probably transfer along the question that you might have. And that's the way we'll work with it. I'm Larry Mueller. For Garden Talk, Lexi Brode, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at selecting the right trees for your landscape, and probably talk about turf grass as well here on the Ideas Net. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, visiting with Diana Olfuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. And great to have her along. And certainly, again, I hope you'll join in with your questions. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. We'll see if we can get you on the air. We have an email from our Bill, actually, in Madison called to ask if he should take the leaf mulch out of the garden. We kind of answered that before planting his peppers. You do want peppers to be warm, right?
That, yes. And so if he's like put leaves over the garden for over the winter, that will keep the soil cooler longer. And maybe he wants to like push those off to the side, let the soil warm up, plant everything, and then put the leaves back as mulch, like we talked about, over newspapers or even just by itself is going to help. And you have to be careful. We always want to be working organic matter into the soil, but ideally it's composted first, or at least partially decomposed. And so if it's whole big leaves, you don't want to work a lot of that into the soil before planting, because then it's going to be decomposing in the soil, and that might goof up your nutrient availability, especially nitrogen, to your plants. So it's better to be used as a mulch. I guess it kind of depends on how many leaves he's got on his garden. But that's absolutely right. It's going to keep the soil from warming up.
Mary also wondered if when should she start bell peppers so that she's not waiting until the fall harvest?
Well,
can she get them started inside in April?
Yes, yes. And bell peppers will take, the packages usually say 6 to 8 weeks before planting them outside. And as you mentioned, Larry, peppers like warm weather, so they're right in there with tomatoes. So putting them out early, like early May, if the soil temperature is still only 45 degrees and the nights are cool, you're not gaining anything with that. So you can put broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage and those crops that like cool weather, you could put those out as soon as your soil can be worked, and they're going to be okay. But the warm season crops, like the peppers and eggplants and tomatoes and the vine crops, they need that soil to be warmer. So, you know, I always tell people to put on their holiday wish list a soil thermometer so that you can monitor it, because it's different wherever you live, depending on your soil conditions. Sandy soils warm up faster than clay soils. And tomatoes want that soil to be at least 60 degrees before you plant them, and peppers are pretty darn close to that. So you don't want to be thinking about putting peppers out until late May, depending on where in the state you are. So if you count back 8 weeks before, that's when you should be starting them indoors so that they get a good head start. And if you can grow them under some light systems indoors, they're going to be nice and strong and robust and ready to go out by the time the soil's ready for it.
Let's try another phone call here and see if we can get Griffin online. Griffin in Sauk County, hi.
And robust and ready to go out by the time the soil's ready for it. Let's try another phone call here.
No, we're just not getting through now. Griffin, I know Lexi was helping me out a little bit on this, was wondering about using black walnuts or buckthorn as a mulch. Now that's not, I wouldn't use black walnuts. Wouldn't use buckthorn either.
No,
but
I'm pretty sure buckthorn also has, it's called allelopathy, and it's compounds within the plant that gets into the soil basically and knocks out the competition. And black walnut is our most notorious offender in that regard. So it keeps other plants from growing so that it doesn't have to compete with them. And I'm pretty sure that buckthorn also has some, although it's not as strong of a effect. But definitely I would not put black walnut mulch, leaves, anything, yeah, anywhere no. near anything I wanted to grow, because there are some plants that are tolerant to it, but there's an awful lot of them that are very susceptible to the effects, and that's better used as firewood.
Yeah, better used as firewood. And if you've got black walnut trees in your yard or in the neighbor's yard nearby, you know, sometimes maybe a raised bed where you put some sort of barrier at the bottom of the bed so the roots can't get down to it.
Yep, and then you also want to try to prevent the leaves from falling on top and getting worked into the soil.
It's a pain.
It is. And we got to remember, too, that a tree's roots, you know, sure there are a few that go down, but the majority of a tree's roots go outward in the top 12 to 15 inches of the soil, and they can go out 2 to 3 times the height of the tree. So if you've got a 50-foot black walnut right on the property line with your neighbor, it's coming into your yard probably 100 feet. So you don't have the problem just right next to the tree. It travels.
It sure does. Mary was wondering about starting onions. She's been struggling with producing good size onions and wants to know how early she should start with onions.
Well, if she's starting them from seed inside, onions actually take quite a long time. And I know I've started them before at the end of January, beginning of February even. So the nice thing is they don't take up a lot of space when you're growing them indoors. But if you haven't started them yet, the ways to get bigger onions, if you're looking for the big ones, step one is plant a variety that genetically wants to get big, okay? Yeah. So you can't take one that's, you know, if in the catalog it says it gets to be a 2-inch onion, you're not ever going to be able to get it to be a 6-inch blooming onion, okay? So first to start with a variety that will get big. The second thing is grow them from plants rather than from sets. So it's real convenient to get the sets, but onions are biennials. So the first year they grow from seed and they form a, you know, somewhat of a bulb. And then the second year they'll grow that bulb a little bit more, but then they send up their flower stalk. And once their flower stalk, their seed head is coming up, the bulb pretty much stops expanding. So you want first year plants, which are ones you either grow from seed or that you buy as plants. The next thing is don't stick them in the ground too deeply, because the soil will actually restrict their expansion. So it's only the roots that need to be in the soil, and the bulb itself, I know we have some market growers that they barely get those roots in the soil, and the bulb forms above the soil surface. They say that, you know, it just expands better that way. And onions are also kind of big. They need quite a bit of nitrogen, so make sure that you're giving them enough nitrogen, especially early in the season, so that they can grow big. And as well as water, because it's the water that expands the cells and expands the bulb. So it's kind of a combination of a bunch of those things, depending on, again, now, I personally don't like big 6-inch onions because I can never use a whole big onion. I like the smaller ones. So everybody grows onions a little bit differently and has a little bit different wants from that regard.
Talking today with Diana Alfuth, a UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls, our guest today. Give us a call. We'll try to get you on, or if we don't get you on, Lexi will be taking some information from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on the Larry Mehler Show Facebook page, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. So give a call. And we'll see what happens. Jeremy from Racine called to recommend a flamethrower or weeder for weed control.
Right, yes, that is a somewhat organic way. I mean, you're still burning fuel and stuff, but that's once weeds are up. And you got to be careful. I don't recommend you use it around wood mulch because there have been instances. But that's weed control once the weeds are up. And obviously, there are lots of ways besides just hand pulling to control the weeds once they're up. Another thing we should mention, though, is ways to stop weeds from sprouting, like in your perennial bed and stuff. There are pre-emergent herbicides out there that you can get, and trifluralin is the most common active ingredient. People are probably familiar with it as preen, and basically what it does is it stops weed seeds from germinating. So if you get out early before your perennials are really, you know, when your perennials are just starting to get up there, and you sprinkle this around them, it will stop most of the weed seeds from germinating in the first place. And then later on, the canopy that's formed by your maturing perennials will shade things out. I don't recommend you use that in your vegetable garden because it is a synthetic chemical, but it helps. You know, it stops the weeds from getting there in the first place between your shrubs and perennials. But there is an organic alternative that you can use in your vegetable garden or in your perennial beds and stuff. And it's called corn gluten meal. And a lot of people are familiar with it. It's the byproduct of the corn milling process. So when they press out the corn oil and things like that. And it's used for animal feed, but they've also found that if you sprinkle that on the soil between your plants, it will release compounds that stop weed seeds from germinating. It basically kills the first little root that comes out of a seed. So you can prevent the weeds from getting there in the first place. Now, Preen is the most common brand that's out there, but they also have Preen Organic or Preen for Vegetable Gardens. And if you look at the active ingredient, it's corn gluten meal. You can also sometimes buy corn gluten meal from feed stores and use that. It will last for about 7 to 8 weeks or so, and then you would want to reapply it. But a lot of times that's going to stop that first flush of weeds from growing, and so you're way far ahead of the game. So using chemical herbicides for weed control is controversial. You know, we don't want to use that stuff any more than we need to, but this corn gluten meal is a good option for stopping the weed seeds from germinating in the first place, and then we don't have to worry about them later. If you're using herbicides to kill existing weeds all the time, you really should be looking at your management processes and seeing how you can maybe prevent the weeds in the first place. So if you have weeds in a shrub bed or a perennial bed or flower garden, get out the mulch, okay? And then you shouldn't need the chemical herbicides. If you've got a lot of weeds in your lawn, we should be looking at your lawn management practices and how much fertility you have in your soil and how you're mowing your lawn, because you know, there's always going to be some weeds, sure, but we want to try to reduce them as much as possible so we don't have to resort to herbicides, because that takes time and money, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Kate and Mazamani wondered if you have any tips for growing cilantro and keeping it alive. Apparently, she has problems keeping it alive.
Oh, well, that's interesting, because it's usually considered a pretty easy herb to grow. So cilantro doesn't like to be too wet, so if you overwater it, that's not necessarily a good thing. You want to make sure that you have basic fertility. You know, it doesn't really need anything way out there, like a high pH or a low pH or anything like that. It's pretty adaptable. So, I guess we'd have to find out what exactly her cilantro is or isn't doing to figure out maybe where the problem is.
You need to have it sunny, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yep. It's going to want full sun. The only time that I've really seen problems with it is if it's like a really cool, wet time and the plants just really, like, they grow an inch and then they stop and they don't grow much more. And it's basically because there's some root rots and issues going on in there, and the plants aren't able to take up nutrients, and that's what I mean. It doesn't like to be in real wet soils. But other than that, you know, like I said, we'd kind of have to know exactly what the symptoms are.
Ron in La Crosse wondered what you think of mushroom compost and what you think about burning leaves as fertilizer. I don't know that I'm...
Mushroom compost is basically compost where somebody's produced mushrooms and stuff, and it's all organic matter. They usually start with wood chips or wood shavings, and then as it breaks down and it holds a lot of moisture, that's where they use it to grow the mushrooms, and then after a while, they start fresh. It's a great soil amendment. You just want to make sure that, like we talked about earlier, that it's pretty well decomposed, that you can't, like, recognize chunks of wood in it and stuff, because it will continue to decompose in the soil, and that might rob your plants of some nitrogen and stuff. So if you can still recognize chunks of wood in it, it's best to pile it up and let it compost for a while longer. But it's great stuff. You know, it's a good soil amendment, and I don't know how much of it we have available around here. I know it's always been a big asset out in Pennsylvania where they grow lots of mushrooms.
Yeah, it's kind of expensive when you do find it around here, for
Is
sure.
It?
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
And burning leaves as fertilizer, so you get, there's ash, I guess, you get from...
So I don't think I would burn them first. One of the things, ash, and it, like wood ash, people will use like the ash out of their fireplace, or if they have a wood furnace, and put that on their compost pile or in their garden. A little bit of ash is fine, but ash is very alkaline, so it will raise the pH a lot, and it also can goof up your balance of nutrients, and I'm not going to remember exactly which ones are involved, but it's like magnesium and calcium and stuff, because you're getting too much of one and not enough of another. I really would prefer that you compost those leaves instead, even just for a year, and then use it as a soil amendment, because then you're adding that organic matter, that fiber and stuff that otherwise you're just burning away, and the nutrients that are in those leaves will, you know, be added to the soil as you add it as compost. So I don't think you're gaining anything by burning them first, but if you do burn leaves and you have some ash left over and it's just a little bit and you throw that on your garden, there's no harm in that, but you're not really, it's not really a beneficial thing.
Okay, so
as far as I know.
Casey in Viroqua asks why his Honeycrisp apple tree isn't growing. He says all his other fruit trees are fine, but the Honeycrisp leaves all fall off by August.
Okay. So I'm assuming that they leaf back out the next year then.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a fungal issue going on. So it might be starting out as spots on the leaves or some kind of lesions and stuff, and that's usually caused by apple scab or cedar apple rust. But he says his other trees are fine. Honeycrisp is not super resistant, but it's not also not super susceptible. But especially if this happened the last 2 years, we had a lot of fungal pressures the last 2 years because we had so much rain and moisture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And early on in the spring. And so we had really, really happy fungi the last couple of years. So if it's basically the last 2 years, 2-3 years that this has been a problem, if we get a drier and warmer, more normal season, which of course nothing's normal anymore, is it, Larry?
No.
and I keep thinking, you know, we're due for a drought because we've had these wet years here, and I don't want a drought, but drier weather would help us with some of these fungal things. So it sounds like that tree is stressed for one reason or another, so it's shutting down early by August. If there's spots and lesions on the leaves, it's probably a foliar fungal thing. If the leaves are still looking fine, but they just like go into fall early, then we would start looking at some kind of a break or a problem in the connection from the roots to the top of the tree. So trunk damage, if there's a big scar or wound on the trunk or bark peeling off, or if there's something within the root system, there might be a girdling root in there or a restricted root system from one reason or another that is
creating the problem.
Yeah. And it's like maples. When we see maples starting to turn color in August, they're shutting down early because they've got some kind of a problem with the root to canopy connection. So it kind of depends on if there's spots on the leaves or not.
Terry in Adams County. Let's try the phones again, see what happens. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Wow.
All right. We have calls. All right.
I have wooded the property in Adams County, very, very sandy property. And when we get high winds and storms, some of the jack pines and other trees with the more shallower roots have a tendency to be uprooted and come down. And I wondered if your guest had any suggestions on tree species that I could plant in a sandy soil where the roots are going to be deeper and a bit more substantial in holding the tree when the storms come.
Mm.
Well, that's an interesting question. I will say that the what we call wild cedars, eastern red cedar is our common name, and jack pines tend to have kind of the shallowest roots. They grow outward quite a bit, and part of that is because they don't like wet feet, so they're near the surface of the soil. Sandy soil gets a little hard because the plants, the ones that are going to grow deeper roots like more moisture, so they don't do that great on sandy soils. But for the most part, things like maples and oaks, they have a more substantial root system, and they should do better. The jack pines, of course, because they're evergreen, the wind can catch those needles, and there's more wind force on them to tip them. And I'm guessing that it's when the sand is wet that they're doing most of the tipping.
Most of the damage, yeah. But there's a reason there's a lot of maple trees in northern Wisconsin, in that sandy areas.
Mm-hmm.
In our area, we're faced with oak wilt.
Yeah.
You know, whereas we could get away with the number of oak trees, you know, on the property, those are getting hit by oak wilt, so we're losing those. And then the problem that I observed, I wouldn't have expected it until I saw it happen, but as the trees thin out on the land, on the property, the wind creates even more havoc with those trees that are more exposed.
The ones that are left.
You know, I might suggest that you talk to your local DNR forester, because you're talking about a big woodlot here and stuff, and they might have some management plans. Obviously, you're probably not the only one dealing with this. So they might have a better idea of exactly in that area which trees do better or how to manage that.
Yeah.
Given that you have the oak wilt issue in there, and I mean that's statewide, we have oak wilt, but you know, maybe they would have some better suggestions than I can give you in a situation like that.
I think that's really good advice. And they're happy to help with that sort of thing. So your DNR forester, you should be able to find that number. I can't give it to you right off the top of my head, but there's one in the Adams County area, I'm sure.
Most counties, or maybe there might be a couple counties together that share one, will have somebody. They do work with the managed forest law and that sort of a thing. And,
yep.
And like I said, they're going to know your local area best.
Thanks for calling, Terry. Diana Alfuth, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today on Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfuth. And Diana, of course, is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Join in. Our phone lines are working now. So the number is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You got a nice garden photo? Put it up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'd love to see it. Or maybe you've got a plant that has a particular issue. We'd love to see that as well. Josh in Madison up next. Josh, hi.
Hey, Larry and Diana. I didn't get my garlic planted in November, and I'm wondering if I planted it now, would anything happen?
I'm sorry, you got what?
Garlic.
Oh, garlic.
If he planted it now, would anything happen yet this year?
Maybe. If it's still, did you have it like in a refrigerator or something over the winter?
Yeah, actually, they've been outside. They just haven't been in the ground.
Okay. Well, as long as that bulb has been, like, stored okay. So if it's been cool and the bulb is still intact, you can plant it and it will start to grow and you will get green things and stuff, but how big of a bulb you end up with by the end of the year is to be determined. Okay, so it kind of depends. So normally when we plant it in October or so,
yeah.
And what happens is the roots of the bulb are active in the soil yet in the fall, and they get really, really well established. And then this time of year in spring, when the soil thaws out, the roots are already established, so the top can start growing and the bulbs can start expanding and all that sort of a thing. As long as that bulb is still okay and can still grow, it's got to start that process now, okay? So it's got to grow roots first, and then it's got to grow top, and then it's going to, worry about expanding the bulb. And that's what we don't know, is how long that's going to take. So you might get bulbs. You're going to get them later than normally. Normally, we're harvesting them in July or so. But they're also going to be affected by day length and the length of the day and the lighting conditions. So that's why it's kind of hard to say exactly what you'll get, because it's light, it's weather, it's how healthy those bulbs still are. I would definitely give it a try.
Why not?
If nothing else, once the green stuff starts growing, that's wonderful, yummy stuff, because the foliage tastes garlicky as well. And even if you get small bulbs, you can use that to replant next year and get back on the normal schedule. So you can harvest that in September and turn around and replant in October, and then you'll be back on the normal schedule for next year.
Yeah.
But I would definitely do it, but I can't promise you what's going to happen.
not much for this year, perhaps. Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it. Betty in Wauwatosa, you are next. Hi, Betty.
Hi there, Larry. Good morning to both of you. This is just the most appropriate program that you're having today. I've been agonizing with what to do with weed control in our backyard. Our backyard is abuts our neighbors, of course, and they have four beautiful little children. And I'm so concerned about using any type of chemical preparation. And yet the landscape service that we have tells me that's the only way we're going to get rid of it. So your comments on that corn preparation are very appealing to me. What are your thoughts?
Are you talking about in your lawn?
No, in a flower bed.
In flower bed. Okay. So first, it depends on what kind of weeds you have, whether they're annuals or perennials. So the corn gluten meal will stop weed seeds from germinating, but it's not going to do anything to weeds that are already there.
Okay. So what I have here is probably buried 6 inches in the soil. I have some snow on the mountain, and of course the wonderful little purple flowered creeping Charlie.
Yeah. So how old are these kids, and how good are they at digging out creeping Charlie?
That's the issue. They're young. The
sure.
oldest is like 10. She probably could help, but the other ones are younger and toddlers. And they're very good. They never even step foot into our flower beds other than to just call across the yard and say, oh, we just love to see your flowers. They're delightful little children, but I'm just really concerned.
Yeah, understood.
Right, and creeping Charlie's hard to get rid of with or without chemicals. And, it's a challenge. But in a flower bed, in that your situation, my best suggestion would be to gather a bunch of people, mm-hmm. Have a barbecue, have a weeding barbecue mm-hmm. or something where you feed them and everybody gets to pull a bucket of creeping Charlie. But if you can get in there this spring as stuff is first getting going and pull out that creeping Charlie as best you can, you're never going to get it all, and there are creeping Charlie seeds in there, but then put down like 4 inches of shredded wood mulch in between your perennials on top of where the creeping Charlie was. So you're trying to clear out as much as you can, and then you're trying to smother out the rest of it, okay? That's going to go a long way towards reducing how much of it you have. And then every time that you see a little sprig popping up here or there, if you can pull it out of there as quickly as you can, that might give you enough control that you can live with. And it may not be that you're ever rid of all of it, but even in a perennial bed, there's not really a good chemical solution either, because
no.
you can't spray the creeping Charlie without probably also damaging your perennials. And creeping Charlie, even with chemicals, takes multiple applications. I really don't typically recommend it in a perennial bed, because you can spray the stuff that's in between the perennials, but you can't get the stuff that's crawling through the perennials, which of course it does. You got to hand pull that anyway. So
I'm telling you, you've got a 10-year-old there, Betty, that you next door. My daughter and I I'm always amazed that we go out to pick creeping Charlie in. We do it right in the lawn to get it out of the lawn, and in a half hour, you will be amazed at how much you can pull in just a half hour with a couple of people. I mean, you can get big piles of it, and then you're ahead of it.
Yeah, yeah. And even 6-year-olds, you can make a game of it. They can even help with pulling creeping Charlie.
Sure.
But I wouldn't necessarily take the lawn services advice that you have to be using a chemical on it, because there's not anything really that's going to select for the creeping Charlie and not bother your perennials. And you're right. You don't want to use chemicals any more than you have to, and you don't want to expose children or adults to that stuff if it can be avoided. So a combination of pulling it and then smothering it is probably your best bet.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks, Betty, for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Dale in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to relocate my vegetable garden to a spot on my lawn that has had it's been there 15 years, beautiful thick grass. And I'm wondering what's the best way. I mean, am I better off actually like getting a sod cutter and stripping that, or would I prefer, can I just, if I covered that, like starting as soon as possible with black plastic or something. Would that, what I'd like to do is kill that grass and then maybe till it up and then, you know, amend the soil somewhat with, I don't know what, you know what I mean, some additional soil. Is that the best way to do it? You know, and not have the grass come back again?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're asking here. And the thing is that with our lawn grass, that's typically Kentucky bluegrass is in there, and that's spreads by rhizomes and stolons.
Over the years. Yeah. I mean, it's been fertilized over the years, and it's beautiful lawn, you know.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But you've got these rhizomes and stolons of that grass in there, and so if you were to just, like, rototill it up, every little node on that rhizomes and stolons is going to sprout back, and you're going to have a nice lawn back within a few weeks. So you're right. You do have to kill that grass one way or another first. So smothering it with black plastic works, but you're not going to get that done this spring in time to plant this year.
No.
Because it takes longer. You can put black plastic over, and within like 2 weeks, you pick up that plastic, and it's going to be all brown, and it's going to look dead, but the roots aren't dead yet. There's a lot of energy stored in those roots, and so to use black plastic to smother out grass, you have to leave it on there for probably 2 months to really kill it off. Otherwise, there's still going to be some life left in some of those roots that's going to come back. Okay, so your other option is to use an herbicide, so like Roundup. But, you know, we don't always want to use something like that where we're going to be growing vegetables, but that does kill the roots. A sod cutter to cut out some of, you know, the majority of that, it is helpful, but you're not going to get all of the roots because the sod cutter only goes down like an inch maybe, and some of those grass roots are 2-3 inches down, even more if you've had a really nice healthy lawn. Ideally, you know, your grass roots are 6 to 8 inches deep.
So you're still going to have to cover it.
You're still going to have to do something else because the grass will still want to come back.
There we go. That's grass is really wants to come back every single time. So covering it can still help. Diana Alfeth is our guest today. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County and teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Our guest on Garden Talk. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mealer with my guest Diana Alfeth, a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She does a great job, doesn't she? Fun to have her on. With lots of callers online at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page as well. If you got a nice garden photo, I'd love to see that, as a matter of fact, on that page. We have, Diana, we have lots of callers who want to visit with you.
That's because weeds are such an issue, isn't it?
And there's other things, too. There's Brian in Mineral Point has something. Maybe weedy? Yeah, there might be a little weed question here. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how goes it?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Definitely. Well, I've got a few issues I'd like to cure all with. I have a long hill, sloped driveway that has a lot of weeds on it. I don't like to mow it if I don't have to. And I would also like to help control erosion on it. And I thought I would do this by planting trees up either side of the gravel driveway. And I want it to be pretty. I have a lot to ask for. I have a big plate. Is there anything that you might suggest?
Yes, actually. I don't know if you want to do trees so much, because sometimes trees along driveway basically make snow fall into your driveway and drifting and visibility and all that. So I'm going to suggest more of a low-growing shrub, something like Grow Low Fragrant Sumac, which is it's going to get a couple feet tall, and it creeps and it roots and it forms just a nice big solid thing. You don't have to weed it after it's established or anything. Or cut leaf stephanander is one of my favorite little shrubs. That would be a good one too. Or you can even just plant it into a no-mow grass mixture. And if you just Google no-mow grass mixtures, you'll be able to find it. Prairie Nursery down in Wisconsin there has it. And it's a mixture of fescues that only get about 8 to 9, 10 inches tall, and then they stop growing. So you don't have to mow it. It looks pretty uniform. Once it's established, it pretty much smothers out most weeds. You hardly ever get any weed things growing in there. It doesn't flower or anything, but it looks nice and green, and it's really low maintenance. And for tough situations like that, it's a really good option. And all of these are going to hold the soil so that you're not going to have erosion issues. But they do take a little bit till they get established, so you'll have to maybe use some erosion blankets or other methods to
get them going, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. What was the first one, the sumac you mentioned?
It's Grow, GROW.
And great.
Yep. It gets pretty inconspicuous little flowers. It's real fragrant if you, like, crush the foliage and stuff, but it's a great option.
Yeah.
Very cool. I'll look into those. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Pete in Germantown, your turn now. Hi, Pete.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Hey, I have a problem. I have some Austrian pines that are turning brown, and it's weird because I lost one a couple years ago, and they start turning brown on the southeast side of the tree, and then it goes up, and then the whole tree turns brown.
Mm.
And somebody told me it was a fungus. I tried spraying them last year with a fungicide, and it seemed to help. But now I'm looking at them this spring, and they're turning all brown again.
Yeah. So Austrian pines are not known for the longevity.
Yeah.
They're pretty susceptible to a lot of diseases and insects and things like that. So it's hard to say exactly what you've got going on. What's interesting is that it starts on the southeast side. And if there's ever a pattern in something, we look at environmental things. So nature, like fungal spores, they land randomly. And so you'd likely see them on, you know, all sides of the tree and stuff. So if you've got something like this going on, I would first start looking at environmental things, whether it's drought, whether it's wind, whether it's herbicide overdrift or spray, whether it's something along those lines. But it's going to be a kind of hard thing to diagnose without digging into, you know, more of the symptoms and stuff like that. Okay. Is it turning like brown all over? Is it just the tips of the branches, or
it starts? It's the new growth is turning brown from last year.
Oh
yeah. See, there are some tip blight fungi that do get Austrian pines. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things that to really tell what's going on, we'd have to investigate it more and maybe send a sample into the disease diagnostics clinic and see if there are some fungal spores in those tips that are dying off. And that'll tell you if it's fungal in nature. But quite honestly, spraying Austrian pines for fungicide is going to be something you'd have to do regularly forever. And it might be...
You might consider pruning right at the base.
Yeah, it's that one-cut pruning method that's maybe you need to start looking at replacement, but...
they're about 11 years old.
Okay.
They're beautiful trees. They're actually on the shoreline on a lake. They're not on the shoreline. They're maybe back 30, 40 feet, but...
Yeah.
You know, and the one that I did have to remove... It started turning brown, and within a week, it was gone.
See, fungus isn't going to do that. Typically, what we're looking at there is that there's something in the root system or in the trunk system or something. You know, it could be, we see that with evergreens when they were drought stressed 2 years ago and there was a lot of root damage or vascular system damage, and then all of a sudden they collapse. So if they're going that fast, there's something major going on.
It's not for lack of water.
Yeah. Well, it might be too much water.
Yeah, that could be it, too.
Yeah, roots get suffocated, and they, you know, you get a root rot in there, and they collapse. So that's what I mean. That's going to take some investigating.
Yeah. Okay, it almost sounds like I got some more firewood coming.
Yeah.
I think you do.
Sounds like it to me, anyway. Good luck, Pete. Thank you. Tom in Manitowoc, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I just wanted to offer a few of my experience is the earlier caller who asked if you could plant garlic in the spring. I've been doing that for a long time with my leftover sprouted bulbs, and what happens is you just get like one bulb about 1 inch, and it isn't segmented like a regular garlic bulb the individual cloves, but it turns out real nice because you have like a 1 inch bulb, and it's real easy to use and peel. And then your other caller was having a hard time growing cilantro. I would also offer my advice that you grow it only in the spring and the fall, because it does not grow well in hot weather. And also, if you're at a greenhouse and you see cilantro in a small pot, do not buy it, because it'll never materialize. Only plant from seed.
Only plant from seed. But I've had people buy it in the store and turn around and have good luck with it, Diana.
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, there are times, you know, where that plant gets stressed in that small pot, and that might be the problem. You know, if it wasn't watered properly, or it got too hot in the greenhouse, or something like that, and that plant gets so stressed that then you try to grow it at home and it just never really recovers from that stress. So that might be what's going on there. But I've had good luck buying them as little potted herbs along with all my other little potted herbs. And once it's gotten out to where its roots can expand and in the garden, and had really, really good luck. So you know, I don't know that being in a small pot is detrimental, but it, as with every plant, it depends on what the early life of that plant was.
Yeah, for sure.
One other thing too is that I planted every 2 weeks, because it doesn't stay very long. It takes on kind of a pungent, kind of a different flavor. You can still use it, but it's not very appetizing.
Yeah.
And that's a really good point. A lot of those herbs, their flavor is very dependent on the weather. And like you said, cilantro doesn't really like the heat of summer so much. And the flavors will change growing in hot, dry weather versus growing in cooler, moister weather. So cilantro is one that that very much does change depending on growing conditions.
Yeah. Tom, thanks a lot. Appreciate the suggestions. Go to Jim next in New Auburn. Jim, hello.
Hello. I've been saving up questions, waiting for a horticulturist to be on your show, and I have three if you have time for all.
All right, well, let's start with one.
Every year, in spite of a regular spraying program in my orchard, my plum trees' leaves get what I refer to as shot holes. They're tiny little holes in the leaves.
Uh-huh.
Should I worry about that? Should I try to do anything about it?
I wouldn't, because the leaves don't fall off, do they?
No.
No. So we got to remember that there's a lot more leaves on a tree than the tree actually needs. Nature knows things like this is going to happen. So as long as there's a lot of green tissue on that leaf yet, a few holes or a few spots doesn't affect the health of a tree. It's pretty much cosmetic. There's still a lot of green tissue there to do photosynthesis and feed the tree. If a leaf gets damaged enough where it's not pulling its weight, the tree will drop it and sprout a new bud if it needs to. But I would not worry about that one bit. It's only affecting the leaf. It's not affecting the tree as a whole, and it's not going to affect your production.
Okay, what's next?
Thank you. Raspberries. I had a raspberry patch for years, and after the first couple of years of bountiful production, the production tapered off, and I've heard people call in to your show with that same problem before, but I've never heard an explanation for why that happens. Is there... what can you tell me about it?
Raspberries, usually we say if you plant a raspberry patch, you get 10 years out of it. And then what happens is there are a lot of viruses that raspberries get. And it's not anything that's real visible to us, but, you know, it's not like, you know, leaves turn goofy colors or anything like that, but it lowers production. Now, if yours is a younger patch, we don't expect that you've got a lot of virus buildup in there, but you might have had some virus buildup in there. There are also other things like root rots that get in, if it's an area that's got too much moisture, maybe, or something. And then the root system just isn't as strong, so you're not getting new canes forming. There could be a couple of things going on there, but most of the time when raspberry patches start to go downhill, it's because of viruses are building up in the patch. And then we recommend that you start a new patch.
In a different place.
Okay.
Right, with new plants, not by taking plants out of your patch and planting them to the new place. Plants, once a virus is in a plant, it's in there forever.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's a very good explanation. My third question, if you have time for it.
Okay.
I have used wood mulch under my fruit trees because I manage them for low branches, so they're easy to harvest, and I can't. It's difficult to mow under under those low branches. So I have used wood mulch. What I find after a few years is that the ground under that mulch is just full of what I believe are mole tunnels. They could be gopher tunnels, but I think they're moles. I'm not sure that it's a problem, but I'm kind of asking you if it could be.
Yeah, it's probably not a problem, and moles will come in to eat grubs and worms and larvae and pupa and other things that are in the soil. And as you're adding that wood mulch and it's decomposing, you're getting a lot of organic matter, and then that's good habitat for worms and larvae and other insects and stuff. So then the moles are there to eat it. But moles are meat eaters. They're not vegetarians, so they're not going to chew on your tree roots. If there's a lot of it, it can disrupt the soil around the roots and maybe cause some problems that way. But in mature, established trees, that's not likely to be a problem. It's more of a problem in, like a perennial bed or something like that. So I don't really consider it a big problem. And my suggestion would be to maybe put some traps out and at least lower the number of the critters that are in that area.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And I just got to point out that Eric sent a photo up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you might want to take a look at it as you're listening today. It started his pepper plants 2 weeks ago under grow lights and tomato seeds last week. The peppers are just getting their true leaves now. By mid-April, I will put them in my cold frame to soak up the sun. The cold frame picture is from last year, and he's nice-looking cold frame there. Looks like he made it himself. He's got a couple of windows, and he's got some nice growth going on inside there.
All right, I'm trying to pull it up here, but my connection here is not pulling it up good yet here.
Well, you'll have to look at it later, Diana. Let's go to Edward and Madison in the meantime. Edward, what's on your mind?
Hi, I just got a house. The lawn was in pretty good condition when I bought it, but it does get pretty wet due to the way the neighbor's yards are graded. But I've got a chain link fence with me and my next door neighbor, and our dogs love to race along that fence. And the wet, combined with my dog, has just created this patch of mud. And I just want to know if there's anything I can do to try to get grass to stick there, or just something so it's not muddy anymore.
There's ways to prevent the dogs from going there by what you plant, but maybe you want the dogs to have fun. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't want to break her heart and hurt from her friends.
So at this time of year, there's not a lot you could do. I mean, you could try putting down like some straw or something like that so that there's a little buffer zone, and as the feet are running, they're not digging into the soil itself, okay? And then as things dry out more, as the weather warms up and stuff, you can remove that straw and then let the grass grow back up there. But if they continue to do this, the grass isn't going to stand a chance. So long term, if this was going to be something, in the future, you can get they're called like GeoGrid or some kind of textile things, or think of like plastic honeycombs that you actually put in the soil and then you plant the grass through that. So that helps for, like, you can walk on the grass and it doesn't compact the soil, or you can drive on it. I don't know how well that would work with dog claws and stuff digging in there.
That could be a problem.
I think you might want to put in, like, just a wood path for them there, so that they're just digging into the wood mulch rather than grass, because I think it's going to be really hard to let grass survive with that. I mean, I know I have dogs right now. I have 4 golden retrievers in my house because I'm babysitting a couple of them. And they don't mean to cause harm to landscapes, but they can't help it. So, I don't think there's a good solution. Not that I know of, anyway.
All right.
And especially this time of year when the frost has come out and the soil is so wet, it's very, very soft, and damage is going to be done quickly.
So maybe a mulch or a straw, or just put some wood down and be done with it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Put some nice little brick paver path there, and that way they'll grind down their nails at the same time and you won't have to clip their nails.
That's not a bad idea either. Pavers along there? Why not? Something to think about, Edward. Thank you for calling. John in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, John.
Hi there. See, I have a small pond, and I'm on about my third year of Phragmites detail, trying to control it. And this winter, I went out and got all the old cane stalks out of there, because I don't think when I was spraying it, I was getting all the different leaves and things. And it seems to work good, the stuff the DNR recommended I use. But my question is now that I have good access to it, when it starts coming up, how high should I let that grow up before I spray it? Should I nail it right when it's just coming up, or should I let it get up a little higher?
Sooner rather than later, because the higher it gets, the more it's doing photosynthesis, which is creating food and energy that it's putting in that root system. So you want to stress this stuff as soon as you possibly can. So I would say, 2 inches, I'd be zapping it.
Okay.
All right.
And then watch, because it's whatever's in that root system, it's going to send up another flush of growth. So if you're trying to starve it out, so you don't want it to see the daylight any more than you possibly can.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. How do you control quackgrass in an asparagus garden? Karen wanted to know that. Oh, man.
You know, that's a really tough one. Probably my first suggestion would be to start a new patch and transplant your asparagus crowns into a nice new clean patch, because it's really hard. You can dig out the quackgrass as much as possible, and similar to what we just talked about, if you pull out everything that you see and then you watch it, and as soon as you see a 1-inch sprig of leaf hitting the sunlight, pull it out of there. Theoretically, you can eventually starve it out, okay? And then maybe if you put some mulch on in between the sprouts of the asparagus that are coming up to help smother it and stress that quackgrass more, you can get rid of it eventually, but it's a big job. Now, there are you can use an herbicide. You could use Roundup on it, but most of the time, we don't want to use that around food crops and stuff. And it would be a matter of spraying that before the asparagus is coming up, so that you're getting it just on the leaves of the quackgrass. But that's not something we would recommend that you do, because again, we don't want to be putting chemicals near our food and stuff if we don't have to. So. But then again, it's going to depend on how big your patch is. You know, if you've got a 100-foot-long patch, digging it all out just might not be feasible. So you might bite the bullet and go with an herbicide, but it's not the route we want to take. So quackgrass, there's nothing that's going to kill the quackgrass without killing other stuff, and you just got to kind of dig it out. Or like I said, sometimes if it's really bad, it's easier to just start a new patch.
Yeah. And here we are running out of time. Just a mention here. Barbara on Facebook says the best revenge on Creeping Charlie is to eat it. Young leaves can be eaten raw, cooked, or dried for tea. So
there you go.
There we go. On that note, we are finished. Diana, it's always a pleasure.
It's amazing how fast this goes.
Yeah, it goes pretty fast.
Sure there are a bunch of other questions out there. And, I really do want to invite anybody who didn't get through and has questions. Just send me an email. If you just Google Pierce County UW Extension, you'll find our office website. And click on Staff Directory and my email and pop me an email. And I'll be happy to help with any questions we didn't get handled today.
Thanks, Diana. Thank you very much. Diana Alfeth is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, selecting the right trees for your landscape, and also take questions on turf grass. And Monday at 11, our physical therapists are back to talk about youth injuries in sports. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store.